Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And for those of you who follow along on the Fire and Water Podcast Network or my shows across the various platforms, you're probably wondering, another podcast? Really? You need to do another show? And yeah, fair point, anonymous critic. Yeah, I am doing yet another show. This is really becoming quite the problem. But as those of you out there who record their own podcasts, you know, like I do, that once you get an idea in your head, you really are dying to try it. And even though my schedule is already filled with, I think, half a dozen other shows at any given point, some of which I host, some of which I co-host, and there are some that are on hiatus at the moment, I really loved this concept that I came up with for Fade Out, which, again, is going to be examining the final films of various actors, actresses, directors, producers, maybe even cinematographers or composers, who knows, anyone who basically worked in Hollywood and had a career worth examining. I just like the idea so much of covering the final films and looking at them as, is there comments to be made about these final films? Do they reflect on a career? Were they intended as the final film? Were they thought of as, did the person who made it knowing they were going to wrap up their career with this film? Or was this just happens to be the final film before, unfortunately, someone either retired or passed away? And all that is going to be examined over the course of the next 5 episodes. This show is going to be, I'm going to be doing sort of a test run. Like I said, it's going to be 5 episodes covering different actors and directors, talking about their films, talking about their final films, and I'm just going to sort of gauge the reaction out there in podcast land and on social media and all the various platforms that our shows appear on, and see what people think. And if it gets a good reaction and people really enjoy what I'm doing and they enjoy these shows, then I can continue on and keep going on and on with the show, because there's obviously so many different people to cover. So the initial plan is to do 5 episodes every 2 weeks. And again, we will just see what the reaction is. And I do, before we get to the main part of the show, which is examining a particular film, I do want to get into, you know, where did I get this idea or this notion? And it sort of really dates back to back in the 90s when I worked at Movies Unlimited, the video store chain that was part of the Philadelphia suburban area. And in this case, the store I worked at was the Cherry Hill, New Jersey location. And we had, of course, this is pre-internet. And so we had a lot of reference books on our shelves. We had Roger Ebert's books and a couple other film guides, and I think the Time Out film guide. And one of the ones that we had several copies of, or different editions of, were the Leonard Maltin film guides, which are these giant 1,000-page tomes giving capsule reviews for as many films as you could possibly imagine. And one of the things I really liked about the Leonard Maltin books was in the back were these indexes featuring the filmographies of very relatively, you know, big-name actors, actresses, and directors. And it would list all of their films with the years. And it made it very interesting to be able to go on a cross section and find out, oh, you know, this actor did this movie. Oh, look at Jimmy Stewart was in this. I never even heard of this movie. And then we could try and look it up because, as we've talked about on other episodes of my other movie podcast, the Film and Water podcast, Movies Unlimited had access to everything. And everything that was ever put on VHS, we could get, or at least make an attempt to get. And so that I always found that very fascinating. And I found myself constantly returning to those back pages and looking to see who was, you know, what was the final film of Robert Mitchum? What was the final film of Jimmy Stewart? And I don't know, I've always been fascinated with the idea of closure, of giving the career, giving your creative venture an end point. As a kid, when I would watch television and the occasional TV show that I would watch would get canceled without a final episode, that always irritated me. That the show would just disappear. I liked shows that got a way to say goodbye, even if it was nominal, even if it was just something tossed in at the end because they realized, oh, this is the final episode. When you couldn't go as grandiose as, say, MASH, which, you know, got a 2-hour finale and the whole world watched it. But I've always been fascinated by that, of how someone in a creative world ends their career. And so that's why I thought it was a interesting subject for a podcast. And as far as I know, it's not been covered. There's no other podcast out there like it. If there is, I don't even want to know about it because I'm going to do this one anyway. But I just sort of really liked that idea. And as I've mentioned, the idea burned so brightly in me that I just am marching forward and we're doing this anyway, even though, as I said, I barely have time for the shows that I do now. So that's what we're going to be covering in these 5 episodes, different careers. I don't want to announce the other subjects because I think I like to keep it a little bit of a surprise. This episode, though, the premiere episode, we are going to be talking about the final film probably the most famous movie director ever in history, Alfred Hitchcock. The film in question is Family Plot. My special guest is going to be frequent guest of the across this network, Scott X. So I guess that is going to do it for this intro. We are going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Scott X to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's Family Plot. Stay tuned.
Hello. Do you enjoy movie scores? Do you like science fiction? Do you like fantasy? And do you like movies?
Everything's under control. Situation normal.
What happened?
Had a slight weapons malfunction, but everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Well, I have a podcast for you. Soundtrack Alley. It's a podcast where I take you on a journey through the time of my childhood and beyond to give you a glimpse into the world of movies, science fiction, fantasy, and other films that touch me on a personal level. You'll also enjoy interviews from film composers from famous movies from the past or even current times. Enjoy the interaction I have with guests on my show every so often, and check out other shows that share in guest spots. So sit back, relax, and let the soundtrack world wash over you, and check out Soundtrack Alley. You'll love it.
Master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, is involved in a family plot.
My word. What a grave insult. Please don't take it to heart. We have some live ones we'd like you to meet. There's a medium in the family plot. She's a fake. There's a thief in the family plot.
Absolutely perfect.
There's a kidnapper in the family plot.
I bet that thing isn't even loaded.
There's even a con man and a wild ride down a mountain.
Come on, woman, don't grab me, for God's sake.
But who is buried in the family plot?
For the answer to this and other startling questions, see Alfred Hitchcock's Family Plot.
And we're back, and as promised, we're here to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's final film, Family Plot, which was released on April 9th, 1976. And joining me to talk about this historic film is my pal and frequent podcast guest, Scott X. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be with you today.
That's
a poor Hitchcock imitation, but I'm sure we'll have both of us will probably be doing that at some point throughout the podcast.
How can you not when he had such a memorable patois the way he talked? Like I said, I figured for the first episode of Fade Out, we wanted to talk about one of the biggest people ever to loom in the grand shadow of no pun intended of Hollywood history, and that's Alfred Hitchcock. And so, yeah, we're going to talk about his final film, Family Plot. So, we'll get briefly into the plot of Family Plot. Wealthy and aged Julia Rainbird wants to bequeath her vast fortune to her only presumed living heir, her illegitimate nephew, who is given away as a baby and as such, whose whereabouts and identity she does not know. Rather than go to a private investigator to locate him, Julia instead enlists the more discreet services of her psychic, Madame Blanche, to locate her nephew with a payment of $10,000 upon delivery. What Julie is unaware of is that Madame Blanche is a charlatan who uses basic information of her targets, often uncovered by her actor-slash-taxi-driving boyfriend, George Lumley, to perpetrate the scam. Blanche and George feel this $10,000 is their meal ticket, despite having only scant leads as to the identity and whereabouts of the nephew. Their initial leads indicate that the nephew may in fact be dead, or perhaps not. In reality, the nephew is Arthur Adamson, a jeweler who, along with a secret associate slash girlfriend Fran, have amassed their own small fortune through the theft of gems, largely through kidnapping the gem owners, with the said gems being the ransom paid. Arthur grew up as Edward Shoebridge, the adopted son of friends of the Rainbird's chauffeur. Along with another associate, Edward killed his parents in a house fire 25 years ago and faked his own death in the process, although he has never been declared legally dead since there was no conclusive evidence of such. When Arthur learns that these strangers, George and Blanche, are trying to locate Edward Shoebridge but not knowing the reason, Arthur and Fran believe it's because of their latest kidnapping and thus decide they need to do whatever, including murder, to keep George and Blanche from finding Eddie. The cast in this film includes Karen Black as Fran, William Devane as Arthur, Bruce Dern as George, Barbara Harris as Blanche, Ed Lauder as Maloney, Catherine Nesbitt as Julia Rainbird, and Catherine Hellman as Mrs. Maloney. So let's just start off here. Scott, like, when was the first time you saw Family Plot?
I can't even remember when the first time I saw it was. It's probably been 10 years ago or so, which is relatively recent,
right?
Considering how many times I've seen the bulk of Hitchcock's movies, certainly in his sweet spot in the 50s and 60s with the famous Psychos, North by Northwest, Rear Window, Vertigo, all those. So this one was relatively recent for me.
What was your initial impression of it when you saw it at the time?
My initial impression...
If you can remember that. I was maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, I can, yeah. I mean, I enjoyed the movie, but I thought it was... It didn't seem super Hitchcockian to me, if that's even a word. It seemed a departure a bit from the other Hitchcock movies that I was most familiar with. But as with most of Hitchcock's movies, I think as I go back and rewatch them, there's always so many layers to these movies. And I find each time I watch it, more and more of Hitchcock in it, some of the familiarity with what we've come to expect from Hitchcock. This one in particular was really more comedic.
Yeah.
Then I felt like I was expecting from Hitchcock.
Yeah, I can remember I rented this and I realized that I had a few gaps in my Hitchcock filmography. I have seen at this point every Hitchcock film that he ever made in Hollywood, from Rebecca to this one. But at the time, this was one of the ones I hadn't seen. And so I rented it and I was taken aback kind of by how comedic it was, by how it seemed to be not all, I mean, it's a thriller technically because you've got murders and you've got all sorts of skullduggery, but the tone of it is so light and in a lot of cases silly, and that can be for good or for bad. I was like, wow, he was really leaning into the comedy at the end. And I mean, we'll even talk about like the car chase at one point features a green screen scene that is like practically out of Airplane. It's so absurd in terms of the background sliding around and has no basis in reality as to what anyone would be doing with their driving. And so obviously he was leaning into the comedy part of this very heavily. Now, of course, Hitchcock made comedies. England, and when he was still making movies in England, he was made comedies. It wasn't like he's only done thrillers. But obviously when you think of the, as you just said, the word Hitchcockian, it conjures up a certain kind of movie, and I think almost a lot of people would be shocked at how lighthearted this whole thing is.
Yeah, and you know, Hitchcock always, in all his movies, he has elements of witty dialogue and things that he promotes within sort of this idea of suspense or thriller. But this one more shifted toward the suspense and thriller portion of it was secondary to the witty dialogue comedy hijinks kind of an idea.
Now, when I was watching it again, first of all, the opening credits are about as minimalist as it gets. He gets his name above the title. It says Alfred Hitchcock's Family Plot. And then we get the screenwriter credit, Ernest Lehman, who, of course, wrote North by Northwest for Hitchcock. And then it's directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And that's it. No stars, no nothing. And if you look at Hitchcock's films, basically probably about his last half dozen, he was definitely leaning away from the star thing that he was – and Psycho as well. But he was getting very far away from these big movie star films that you think about in the 50s with Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly and Cary Grant. Here, it's – like I said, it's Barbara Harris, Bruce Dern, William Devane and Karen Black, all of whom had some level of name recognition by 1976, but none of them were of the star wattage that Hitchcock was used to dealing with. And only one, Bruce Dern, had Hitchcock ever really dealt with before. Bruce Dern has a small part in Marnie, so he worked with Hitchcock briefly. But these are all basically new actors to Hitchcock. So it's kind of interesting. I think, was he, you know, and in his last bunch of films, was he thinking, you know, I want to get away. I mean, I know he wanted to get away from the massive budgets. But also, you have to think, by 1976, there was a different crop of movie stars that he would have had to have worked with. Cary Grant was no longer active. Jimmy Stewart was mostly in retirement. Grace Kelly had retired by that point. I did read about that. Apparently, he had offered the Bruce Dern part to, as Hitchcock put it, Al Pacino. And it took somebody to figure out what he was talking about. He realized he meant Al Pacino. And apparently, Al Pacino wanted $1 million to do this movie. And Hitchcock was like, I'm not paying somebody $1 million. And it's sort of funny because he paid Cary Grant that kind of money. But I mean, I guess maybe to someone of Hitchcock's age by this point, he would have been 76 years old because he was born, I think, in 1899. To him, I wonder if Al Pacino was like, who's this Al Pacino guy? I'm not paying him $1 million.
Well, yeah. And Bruce Dern in an interview said that too. He said, you know, Al Pacino was the first choice as far as he knew. But he never said how did Dern say it? He said, and a lot of the other people around Hitchcock said the same thing. It was not, the money was certainly part of it. Hitch did not want to pay the actors that much money. And Dern said he had already sort of felt uncomfortable having recently played Paul Newman and Julie Andrews.
Right.
A $750,000 a piece, I think, in just a movie that was done not too far before. And he was uncomfortable with that. So obviously, if Pacino was asking $1 million, he wasn't going to go for that. But I think also part of it with the Cary Grants and those, Hitch liked to be surrounded with people he was familiar with.
Right.
And for lots of different reasons. And Al Pacino, whatever the money was, he was not familiar with Pacino or Pacino. That gives it right away how familiar he was with them. And so Dern had said in an interview, he said there were other people on the list between Al Pacino and him. Dern said, I think I was like 15th on the list. But when they went down the list, Hitchcock had moved him up above the other actors for that role, and Dern had asked him why. You know, all these other people are, you know, fine actors. Why? And he said, Bruce, I never know what you're going to do next. Hmm. And he was familiar with Bruce Dern, but he also liked sort of his unpredictability on screen. That was something Hitchcock was looking for.
Now, that's interesting, because what we all know of Hitchcock was that he, in a lot of ways, did the movie with basically he mapped the movie out with storyboards down to the last detail, and he actually regarded shooting the movies as kind of a formality, almost. Like, he had the movie so mapped out in his brain. I mean, there's legendary stories of Hitchcock falling asleep in the director's chair because he was so bored with all of it. It was just like, at that point, it became just a technical exercise. So that's interesting that he would find Bruce Dern, he would look at that as a plus. Dern would be this sort of live wire. You would think Hitchcock would not want that.
What Dern told him in this interview that I saw, the Dern said Hitchcock was all about the storyboarding and the look and the feel. He said, in the frame. So he talked about the frame is perfect, Bruce. And then Dern said, but what you do within the frame, he was okay to change dialogue, to do all kinds of other things, as long as you kept it within the frame. And Dern gave this example of, you know, if an actor leaned sideways and waved his hand, but it came outside of the frame, Hitchcock didn't want that. But as long as you kept it within the frame, Hitchcock was fine to modify things because there was no dialogue on a storyboard that he had created. There was dialogue in the script, but he was okay with those changes. Dern talked too about there were certain places in the movie where Dern had improvised dialogue and it had made Hitchcock laugh out loud. So they had to go back and reshoot it. And one of them was, and if you remember when they were, you had mentioned already the car scene careening down the curvy highway. There was a line in there where, you know, Blanche is kind of flying all over the car and they're going down the road and Bruce Dern or Lumley George is steering the car. And he says, I got to get off this road. And that was an improvised piece of dialogue. And they said Hitchcock laughed out loud during that part. And so they had to reshoot.
Well, that's funny. I didn't know that. That's
you go back to the storyboarding too. Karen Black also talked about that. And she talked about how, when she did this movie, it was in the 70s. She said people were improvising all over. If things came out blurry, they didn't care. It was all this kind of new age filmmaking, she said. But Hitchcock was very old school, like you said. She said, Karen Black said, I didn't know he storyboarded. You know, we all know that as Hitchcock fans. He storyboarded all this stuff. And she said, that should never work. She said, it should never work because you edit, you go back, you shoot. It doesn't look like you thought. You have it in your imagination. And she said, but he did it. And he did it perfectly every time. in every movie. And she said that was part of his genius, was that how he imagined things, they turned out that way. She said it was crazy. And that was very interesting to me, too, to think, you know, as an actor portraying a role within his structure of directorship, how she didn't think that it should work. But yet for him, it did.
I have to imagine Al Pacino maybe kicked himself a little that he turned down this movie, because, of course, the reason we're here discussing it, this was Alfred Hitchcock's last film.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a chance to work with Alfred Hitchcock. And as I was watching this movie, of course, most of the cast by now, Catherine Nesbitt, certainly, Catherine Helmand, Barbara Harris, Karen Black, are all passed away now. But a few are still around. William Devane is still around. Bruce Dern is still around, still working. By the way, I looked at Bruce Dern. He has 9 films in different stages of production right now. 9. Wow. 9 during COVID on top of it, 9 yeah. films. Man keeps busy. But I don't know about you, but when you think of Alfred Hitchcock in all caps, you think of him as this, I don't want to use the word relic because that's got a negative connotation, but this icon, that's a better
right,
word.
Icon.
Icon yeah. of golden age, the golden age of Hollywood, which at this point in 2020 seems like, I mean, it's, at this point, it's literally, you're talking almost more than half a century ago, but it seems so far in the past that the idea to me that there are actors walking around today that can say, I worked with Alfred Hitchcock. Like, that's amazing. I was thinking about that when I remembered that Katherine Hellman is in this movie. And now Katherine Hellman is probably more famous for being on Soap and was Mona on Who's the Boss.
Right.
And I think about that Katherine Hellman, who didn't have that much of a movie career, really. She's really more of a TV actress. Nevertheless, within the space of 10 years, worked with Alfred Hitchcock and Terry Gilliam. And it's like, can you imagine sitting around like the craft table at Who's the Boss with someone who worked with Alfred Hitchcock? You know, like, right. I mean, to me, I would just be like, just tell me every story about that, Miss Helmand. Tell me what, you know, you worked with Alfred Hitchcock. It's just amazing. Again, it's hard for me to wrap my brain around that this movie came out while I was alive. You know, like this
right.
film, Hitchcock was still working as of 1976. So,
well, and his reputation was such even then. I mean, like you said, Al Pacino may be kicking himself. In that same interview that I saw with Karen Black, she talked about that. She said when she had an opportunity to work on this film, she said she was offered another picture at the same time. And she said, but it wasn't even a question. I was going to work with Alfred Hitchcock. She said she wanted the role of Blanche was what she wanted the role. But she said, I wasn't given that. And she said, and I was just thrilled to be able to be in the movie, a movie that Alfred Hitchcock was directing.
And he, you know, it's funny. Can you picture her as Blanche? I guess so.
No, I can't. I can't. I mean, she in the interview, she talked about she had this whole idea for what Blanche would have this Southern accent and how her look would be. And basically she said, I passed that message along. And basically Hitchcock just said, no.
I mean,
and I could just see it, you know, no.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, thank you, Mrs. Black. Yeah. I mean, as Fran, he certainly gives her, and I don't mean to skip ahead, but I mean, he gives her a hell of an intro.
Oh, yeah.
She comes into the film. Because,
fantastic.
I mean, Karen Black was already, I think, fairly tall for an actress. And then he puts her in these boots and he gives her this ridiculous hat. And she's in this these dark glasses. I mean, obviously, the studio realized that was a compelling image because she dominates the poster.
Right.
The poster is the silhouette of Karen Black as Fran, and then all the other characters are placed within it. But let me wind back a little bit to the opening scene. Now, I'm curious what you think about Alfred Hitchcock's, in my opinion, his last half dozen films outside of Frenzy, I'd say are some of his weakest. I think of Topaz, Marnie, Torn Curtain. I feel like they are all way too long, way too slow, and just don't have that punch that you think of when you think of Alfred Hitchcock. Even The Birds, which is a very slow burn, when it finally kicks into gear, has some real, real amazing stuff to it. But I feel like during his final last bunch of movies, again, Frenzy excepted, which I haven't seen in a long time, but I remember liking quite a bit, it seemed like his pace got elongated, and I felt like that was going on here with Family Plot. Like the opening scene with Blanche and Mrs. Rainbird, where we learn, obviously, that Blanche is, you know, a charlatan and that she's leading Mrs. Rainbird into giving information and she's fooling her into thinking that she's someone clairvoyant. To me, that opening scene already goes on way too long. Like you get the point. Okay, I got
right.
it. Blanche is a con woman. I get it. But the scene just gets stretched so long that I'm just like, all right, let's move on to the next thing. I get all this. So did you feel that watching this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are portions I definitely felt like that, where and I'm not sure what exactly Hitchcock was trying to accomplish by doing that. Because like you said, it seems like the stage was set. And I also am cognizant of the fact I'm watching this in 2020, and
right.
our personal attention spans are so different now. You know, if I don't get something and my internet goes out and it's, you know, or my internet is slow and I have to wait 10 seconds for a Google search to pop up, I'm like pulling my hair out and I'm going, what is going on?
Come on,
get rolling. So I don't know if that's part of it. Maybe it is. But at the same time, I agree with you. I think the point of the scene that we should be taking away from it as we move along through the story is taken. And there are times in this movie that it maybe gets a little bit more drawn out than it needs to be.
Right. And then it's unfortunately, I think it happens again in the very next scene with Blanche and George in the cab, where they have this conversation. And we learn that, you know, George is a little henpecked. You know, he's kind of like, all right, he's kind of annoying. And again, that scene goes on too long. Like, it just gets stretched out. And then the other thing that's a little on the distracting side, and I don't get too bothered by dated effects because, that's when the movie was made at the time. But this is some of the worst blue or green screening in the history of movies. I mean, the lines around the actors' heads are practically an inch thick. And it is a little disturbing to see these green lines around our actors. And you're kind of like, what is that? I mean, come on. By 1976, they had this technology better mapped out than that. And it looks kind of cheap. And I'm surprised, considering it's a Hitchcock film, that it looks kind of as cheap as it does.
Well, and it's so funny. I think you nailed it before when you said Airplane. Because this was, and I was watching this too. I was thinking, 76, you know, we're within a few years of Airplane. And I felt like Bruce Dern, every time he turned the wheel, you know, the car is going a different direction than the background. And he's driving the wheel. And it was just almost hokey. But I don't know. I almost had to feel like, was that intentional? I don't know.
That's the thing. I start to, it's kind of like that thing that goes on, people talk about with The Shining, that there are so many factual errors in The Shining in terms of continuity and the hotel not being physically possible where the actors walk. And people are like, well, Kubrick was such a meticulous artist that those can't be mistakes. Those must be on purpose. And other directors maybe wouldn't get that kind of grace period. For that
right.
sort of stuff. But and same with Hitchcock, kind of the same way. You're almost like Hitchcock must have almost been enjoying the artifice of it, of presenting the artifice. Because, it's like you look at those green mat lines around the actors and you're like, oh, my God, they look like they're turning into the Hulk or something. Like, what? They're irradiated. And you have to think they must have known in 1976. This is a year away from Star Wars, for Pete's sakes. Yeah, they had to know that it didn't look great. And maybe that was Hitchcock's intention, that he was purposely playing up than just the complete artifice of all this, the silliness of it. And I think this the cinematographer, by the way, of this film is Leonard J. South, who Hitchcock worked with before. He wasn't the cinematographer on Marnie or Torn Curtain, but he worked as a camera and electrical operator, whatever. I'm exactly sure what exactly that means. But he had worked with it again. He'd worked with Hitchcock before, and so I think this whole thing has a slight TV-ish look to it. Like, it looks like TV sets. It looks like maybe like the opening scene again with Mrs. Rainbird and Blanche. It kind of looks like a Columbo episode in some ways.
I think that's right on. I hadn't thought about that. When you say that, I'm like, light bulb. It does. That is what it looks like. But I think Hitchcock had some different ideas with this too. And I think oftentimes he was poking fun at the movie making process. I think you see that in little bits in other movies as well along his career. And it does seem to come more to the forefront here. There was a couple other things kind of with respect to that he made choices that I'm not sure why. I mean, there was some, how do I want to say it? He had the idea of he did not want this movie to be attached to a particular city or location.
Right.
And his assistant director at Howard Kazanjian talked about that. And he said, Hitch came to me and said, I don't want to see any names for anything on anything. I don't want to see names on police cars. I don't want to see names on badges. If there's any name that appears in the script, I want you to change it. I don't want anyone to be able to associate this with any city. And Kazanjian said he never explained to me why.
Right, which is just totally what he seemingly antithetical to what Hitchcock done before, considering yes. every one of his films takes place yes. in a very near recognizable place.
And that's exactly what Kazanjian said, too. He'd taken great pains over the course of his career to be on location and show where these locations were and make it be very epic in that sense. You know, this represents this area. But he didn't want that. He didn't want any of that for this film.
Yeah, I mean, you think about, the original name for North by Northwest was what, The Man in Lincoln's Nose, I think? I mean, yeah. That's literally the original title. But yeah, in terms of Hitchcock playing up the artifice of movies, he obviously did that before. He did that in, I think it's Notorious, where Cary Grant and Ingmar Bergman have a clinch and the kiss goes on for like 3.5 minutes and they even answer a phone call in the middle of it. I mean, which is absurd. And then, of course, you've even, again, in North by Northwest, right at the point where Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint are presumably going to have intercourse, he cuts to a train going in a tunnel for Pete's.
Right.
I mean, Hitchcock was always willing to play up with that. So,
and his sexual innuendos too show up in this, though he has those throughout his movies as well.
Yeah. He was like a kind of like a naughty boy, you know, kind of yes. like winking a little bit like, oh, right. I mean, of course. And he did all that in his trailers and stuff like that. So again, I mentioned the opening scene where we got with Karen Black, where she is wearing the dark wig but the dark glasses and the hat. And she's got the blonde wig and she looks very statuesque. And then we realize that it's sort of funny the way the movie crosses over each other, because it's literally Bruce Dern is driving the cab and Karen Black as Fran is walking across the street and he almost hits her.
Yes.
And because she's not paying attention. And then the movie follows her. And it just, for a while, forgets Bruce Dern and Barbara Harris. And it follows Fran as she perpetrates this kidnapping scam. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I was going to say, Hitchcock discussed that with assistant director Howard Kazanjian again. And he said Hitchcock told him what the theme was. He said it was two separate stories about two different pairs of people and how they eventually crisscross and pass each other. And then Kazanjian said he was fascinated by that, and that really is the movie. And that's exactly what you just said. Right from the onset, we're seeing that crisscross pattern.
Yes, absolutely. And as we follow Fran and William Devane's character, Adamson, we follow Arthur Adamson back to their house. But I do want to mention, in the scene at the police station, and then she goes and gets into the chopper to drop off the ransom for the person they've kidnapped. The actor, did you recognize the actor flying the chopper?
No, I didn't.
That is Alan Fudge. And Alan Fudge's most famous credit, I would argue, for any of us MASH fans, he is Captain Chandler in Quo Vadis, Captain Chandler, the season 4 episode. Oh.
Which I should know that, because that's one of my very favorite episodes, as you may remember.
As soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, look, that's Captain Chandler. Look at that. And he's uncredited in this movie, which seems crazy because he has a big scene. He has multiple lines of dialogue with one of the name characters. It's like, and he's uncredited, which made me sad because I'm like, oh, he deserves to get credited. But, you know, what are you
doing? Absolutely.
Yeah, that was weird to me that he doesn't.
I guess I was distracted by the fact that the chopper looked like it came right out of MASH. With the bubble copter. That was probably why I was distracted. I was watching that more closely.
Maybe so. So we said we follow Arthur and Fran back to their house. And, man, if you want me to like a movie, give me something featuring a secret compartment. Yeah, I am absolutely on board with that. And I love that in this relatively, I mean, yes, it's cartoony, yes, it's heightened, but this relatively normal looking movie, and all of a sudden it looks like we're in Batgirl's secret hideout, because Arthur and Fran have a brick wall that has a fake room embedded in it with control panels under the bricks. It is such a weird idea that these kidnappers would have that built into their basement. You would think they would just put this guy in their garage. I mean, maybe they're worried about that he was yelling, but it's such a weird, fanciful notion that these two are so loaded, and we see soon how loaded they are because they're living in a very nice house, that they have an entire separate room, secret room for their kidnapping. And I just love that crazy detail.
Well, yeah, and it tells you about their characters. They're not in this for a one-off.
No.
This is something they have perpetrated in the past and are going to perpetrate these type of crimes in the future. There's no messing around with them.
Now, William Devane.
I will say that the secret compartment, scratch that. I'll come back to that.
Okay. So William Devane, as he enters into this film, he was somewhat of a movie star, but more of a TV guy. He actually would go on to some other films right after. I mean, after right after Family Plot, he did Marathon Man and Rolling Thunder. He did From Here to Eternity, and so he had, his career kind of got a boost from this. But from what I had read, apparently Hitchcock was not terribly thrilled with Devane's performance.
Really?
Yeah,
because he Devane was his first choice. And then Devane was unavailable.
Oh, right. And they got Roy Thinnes.
Roy Thinnes actually was in production. They shot for 5 or 6 days with Roy Thinnes. And Devane became available. So Hitchcock fired Thinnes and brought Devane on. And apparently that same night, Hitchcock was eating at the famous but now defunct Jack's restaurant in San Francisco. And Thinnes approached Hitchcock in the restaurant and kind of accosted him and said, "Why did you fire me?" And Hitchcock was so speechless and taken aback, they said that he just looked at Thinnes. And they stared at each other for a few minutes until Thinnes just walked away. I can't imagine walking in on Hitchcock and doing that. But then also Hitchcock was just aghast that happened. And so again, they said, you know, and then the assistant director, again, in this interview that I saw from him, he said, "It's always hard for when an actor is fired from a production." He said, especially in a case like this, there was nothing that Thinnes had done wrong. It was simply because he was the second choice. And so that's interesting for me to hear too, that in the end, that maybe Hitch wasn't so thrilled with Devane's performance.
Yeah. I mean, you trust IMDb trivia, you know, at your peril, but apparently there was some sequence where he was watching a scene with Devane in it, and he muttered to kind of no one in particular, "Within earshot of Bruce Tern, I think I've made a horrible mistake," which again seems weird. I mean, he was Hitchcock. I guess he could have, maybe at that point, having fired Roy Thinnes already, he was like, "I can't fire a second guy."
Right. Or bring Thinnes back. How would you do that after that incident in the restaurant?
Yeah. Sorry about that, Roy.
I did have to chuckle. Devane told, I saw an interview with Devane about this movie too. And he was talking about, was talking to Hitch, and you know, who knows how actors may stretch this a little bit, but he said there was a scene where Devane goes and he looks out this window and you see his back. And Devane said to Hitchcock, "Well, you know, my mother isn't going to like that. She really gets upset when she sees the back of my head." And Hitchcock took a brief beat and then said, "Have her destroyed." And Devane said, "I loved it. It was brilliant."
You have to think Hitchcock was sort of obviously at this point in his career, he probably knew that people were expecting those kind of bon mots from him. So he had to sit there and come up with them a little bit. Like people were expecting something pithy and short from him and just something sort of horrible to say.
Right. Hitchcock exactly.
It's kind of de rigueur for him at that point. He could say this kind of stuff. So, after we have the scene with, Fran and Arthur in their house, we meet, the victim of the previous kidnapping plot that we see, and he's getting questioned by police, and he's kind of argumentative. Now, do you recognize the actor playing Constantine in this scene?
I recognized him, but I couldn't place him.
That is Nicholas Colasanto, Coach from Cheers.
Yes.
So it was funny that it's to see another. I'm only familiar with Nicholas Colasanto basically as Coach. He does have a small role in Raging Bull, but seeing him in any other context is still like, "Oh, that's Coach." And here he's really argumentative. And it's a weird idea because it's like they don't ever really fully explain it, but it seems that this guy Constantine is almost maybe humiliated that he's been kidnapped. And that's why he seems so – because he seems very unwilling to help the police catch the person that kidnapped him. But he's like, "I don't know. It was a man or maybe it was a woman. I don't know."
Well, and I like the one where he says she was 25. How do you know she was 25? Because any man who gets kidnapped by a woman wants her to be 25.
Yeah.
It was his response. Like, just leave me alone. This has happened. Let's move on.
Yeah. I also love the piece of set deck, the desk. That if you ever watch this film, and you can rent it on Amazon Prime, by the way, if you look at the desk that Constantine, Nicholas Colasanto, is, it is enormous. It almost doesn't look like a desk. It looks like a credenza or like a bureau. And you're like, no human would need a desk this size. I mean, you couldn't even reach the other side of it, even if you leaned over on it. So it's just sort of absurdly huge and big and loud. And that's kind of what Constantine is in the film. And that's Nicholas Colasanto's only scene in the film. So then again, we find Blanche and she's doing another reading for someone in her home. And then we see that she is a complete BS artist. And at one point when when George shows up and he has to tell her something, and she has to pretend to that she's gone in a trance, and she has to wander into the kitchen just so she can talk to George. And it is Barbara Harris doing sort of high comedy. Her body language, I mean, it's almost like Carol Burnett, the physicality of it, where she's like, oh, yeah. Joe, you know, oh, I'm talking to the dead. And then she whispers, oh, it is that level of silly that you can't believe anyone would buy this. Would really believe that this person is on the level.
And I can't help but feel, again, that may have been some of Barbara Harris, how she portrayed that. But I also think there was some of Hitchcock in that. Mm-hmm. And again, making light of this whole performance, the art of performance and over the top, and
yeah,
him kind of poking fun almost at himself, because I couldn't help but feel like in some ways Blanche was sort of a surrogate or a stand-in for Hitchcock himself. I don't know if you saw the trailer for this movie, one of
yes.
the trailers, where it's like Hitchcock is the one sitting behind. He's the clairvoyant. Mm-hmm. And then Blanche appears in that seat and so forth. Like this was sort of Hitchcock's sort of wink and a nod too about he puts all this stuff on and it's all just crap.
Yeah.
You know, he's putting this on for entertainment and he's getting something out of it, but there's no reality in it, you know?
Now, later on, after George does a little bit of PI work, where he goes to this department store and he tries to find out about this Edward Shoebridge guy, we see their lives together, what George's life is like with Blanche. And as you talked about, that this film does split off into two things, where it's two parallel stories. And it really does show the economic disparity between our two
yes.
couples, because we've got the kidnappers who, again, Arthur is also a jeweler in his real job. They live in utter opulence. They've got this chandelier. They've got this huge house. They obviously have had this kidnapping dungeon installed. I guess they get like the James Bond villain guys to put that stuff in, the henchmen to throw all that, put all that stuff together. But Blanche and George are in pretty dire financial straits. Obviously, George isn't doing very well as an actor if he's moonlighting as a cabbie. And we get the sense that he's not so much moonlighting as a cabbie as that he is a cabbie
who
occasionally does acting.
Yes. Yeah, he and that seems there was a line where what was the guy's name? Maloney.
Goes Ed Louder,
into Adamson's office and he says, I didn't buy it from the start. He said he was an attorney. And to me that underlines again, he's not a very good actor. He is a cab driver.
Right, right. And that's gonna be hard for an actor to play a bad actor. Because you have to
yes.
be a good actor to do that, but then you have to be all the things that radiate as a bad actor.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
I remember reading listening to the commentary track for, of all things, Boogie Nights. And Julianne Moore talks about shooting the scene where she was in – her character is in the porno that they show in that film. And she realized the way you radiate a bad actor is they don't know what to do with their arms. They just they're just dangling off to the side. I'm like, uh-huh. That's what it is. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting note that's a bad actor has no idea what to do with the bit of business. So that's immediately the
they're reading the dialogue, but not yeah. including the physicality.
Right, exactly. So yeah, we've got George going off and doing this investigation, and he goes to the graveyard, and he notices that there's two graves. There's the one for Harry Shoebridge and Sadie Shoebridge, who died in the fire, and Edward Shoebridge. And of course, he notices something in that the Edward Shoebridge's grave seems brand new, seems untouched by weather, when Harry's and Sadie's, which has been around since 1950, they've been dead since 1950, is weather beaten and has gotten rain on it. But he notices immediately that something is fishy here, because Edward's looks like it was just planted.
Yeah, and I found that to be an interesting just little tidbit that he would pick up on that, you know, that although they had the same death date, and you would then assume that they all died together in this fire that he had learned, but the one tombstone, as it stood next, the next looked markedly different, and then it was certainly newer.
Yeah. He goes to visit he talks about the guy that's working at the cemetery to talk about that, and he has a scene with the very, very experienced character actor Charles Tyner, who you have seen in a million things. He was in Harold and Maude, Jeremiah Johnson, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Cool Hand Luke. He had a long career, so he plays the guy at the cemetery, I guess not the grave digger, but the guy who's working in the cemetery. And we see there's a younger woman who's off, who's literally carving the the headstone. She's sitting there with the chisel and carving away at the the names on the headstone. And then George goes to the death register office, and there in the death register office is when we get our cameo by our director.
Yep. Yeah. Hitchcock, again, this was in this Dern interview. Dern was asking him, you know, where are you going to appear? While him and Kazanjian also relates this. Hitchcock said, I don't know that I'm going to appear in this one. I don't think that I'm going to be in this movie. Well, that would be a shame. You know, you've got to appear in this. And then Hitchcock said, well, maybe I will appear, but I won't appear. Something along those lines. He made it very mysterious. And then he was asking, you know, Dern later, what did you think of my appearance? Well, what his appearance was, he appeared as a shadow. His profile was in shadow in a window, in which I find this just so interesting for two reasons. Because it ended up being his last film, you can look back. He appears as a shadow, which to me kind of links in. It's his last film. You know, his shadow is over this whole movie and his whole career looking back. One, he appears in shadow. And two, on the door of the window in which he appears, it's the Registrar of Births and Deaths. Hitchcock's appearance. And so again, that was his last appearance, was his image only, not his person.
And when you think about his silhouette, was one of the most famous parts about him from the TV show, when he would walk, his own silhouette would walk into the little drawing. I mean, that was like one of the most famous. So it's funny that it's a subtle cameo and that he physically doesn't appear, but yet it's a very ostentatious cameo because the camera just points at this very recognizable silhouette and then pans over to the action. Yes. So it's kind of like, oh, hey, here's Hitchcock. All right, back to the movie. And then we're back
again. That idea of Hitchcock being, I know people want to see this.
Yeah.
We're going to let them see it. Then we're going to get back to what's going on here.
Right. And he had talked about in interviews that after a while, when he became famous for his cameos, he used to try to get them out of the way to keep people from getting distracted. Because, of course, if the cameo was in, you know, the second hour of the movie, you're not paying attention to the movie anymore, and you're just like doing the Hitchcock spotting.
Right,
it became a little bit like the Stan Lee to a certain extent. You know, you're just, well, when's Stan going to show up? Okay, there he is. But yeah, to get it out of the way, about he gets it at the run of 45 minute mark. It's like, okay, now we've gotten Hitchcock. So then again, George goes to the gas station, and that's when we meet basically the fifth character in this film, the Maloney, played by Ed Lauder. Who, again, another longtime character actor. You've seen him in 40 million different things.
Yes.
And this was another one that Hitchcock apparently loved Ed Lauder, just thought he was terrific. He had watched The Longest Yard, apparently, with the idea that maybe Burt Reynolds was going to play the Bruce Dern part. And he watched The Longest Yard and just said, basically, get me this Ed Lauder guy. And he had actually planned to work with Ed Lauder again, which is going to get into one of our topics at the end about was this intended to be the final film. But he just thought Ed Lauder was great. And Ed Lauder, as usual, is terrific in this movie as this seedy guy who obviously runs this gas station, doesn't seem to be very interested in it or good at it, because obviously he's got a side gig as essentially a hired hitman.
Right. And he's obviously a crook. And we learn about this a little bit later on in the film, but that he and Arthur Adamson, a.k.a. Eddie Shoebridge, had this long history together of kind of being on the wrong side of the law and kind of working with each other. And then Maloney was there protecting Shoebridge, Adamson, but also just to protect himself. And he was more or less the one that was willing to go to any lengths to keep the secret.
And I love the scene later on where he shows up to talk to Arthur. He shows up to talk to William Devane, and he has to tell him about what's going on, that there's this guy kind of looking for you. And I just love, he's in a suit, Maloney, but he looks so completely uncomfortable, and he's actually even steals some of Arthur's cigarettes. But like, he's like, he's just always looking to kind of scam things, or he's just always looking, you know, it's like he's not the kind of guy you want showing up in your office, especially at your work office, because it's like he just radiates suspiciousness.
Well, and you mentioned before too, you know, these differences in class that we see here in the movie, and Hitchcock had, as he had in many of his movies, he had Edith Head costume this movie,
right?
And the costumes really showed that when you see Maloney at his gas station, and you had mentioned already, you know, George Lumley and Blanche and how they were dressed versus Adamson and Fran and how they were dressed, and this really points this out. Not only was it Adamson's office, he was a jeweler,
mm-hmm.
So it was sort of, he was working with these high society clients. And like you said, he walks in, and there was a great, I thought, kind of a Hitchcock moment too, when he first walks in. The scene just shows Adamson working with some high you know, highfalutin client, and you hear the ring of the bell. The door has opened, and William Devane Adamson looks at, and his face just goes blank. He has this big, you know, salesman smile on his face, and his face goes blank. And then it turns and shows that it's Maloney that's walked in. And I love that because we get the idea of this was a surprise to Adamson just by how it's shot. We don't see him coming in the door. We see his reaction, Adamson's reaction to him coming in the door. Then they cut and we see that it's Maloney.
Yeah. There's an,
totally out of his element in a, like you said, in an uncomfortable dress and in an uncomfortable situation.
Right. And then we see the people that have come, the doorbell or I guess it's the doorbell of the jewelry store, is these two cops who have come to talk about that there's this big diamond missing and that they think that maybe it's getting broken down and shaved into smaller. And there's something really peculiar about the scene, and I can't quite put my finger on it. It's done in a one shot, and it's done almost like dragnet. And that it is so flat on purpose, where these two cops come in, start talking to William Devane, and they start asking him about diamonds, and he's just like, "So, do you understand? You're telling us that the diamonds can be, these can be shaved down and sold for smaller diamonds." And William Devane just gives this very, and it's kind of boring, but he almost. I couldn't put my finger about it, but like, it's almost like it's a comedy scene that it is so flat. It is so lifeless, and it seems so absurd that the way this whole thing – I don't know. I'm here on a podcast, for God's sake. I wish I could have a better way to explain it. But there's something about the scene where it almost felt like Hitchcock was having a laugh, and that it is so dry and bloodless watching these cops talk to Arthur Addison about – jewelry details, and we just know, again, Arthur's all, he's full of it.
Well, yeah, and it makes me wonder, too, again, like you said, it's almost has to be intentional with the sort of the irony of the police coming and asking the jeweler about the jewels, and he's actually the criminal, but they're not there to talk to him about the actual crime.
Right.
They're wanting to know if someone has come into his establishment trying to sell this diamond.
Right.
And so, I mean, it's kind of trying to illustrate, I suppose, that Devane is this cool customer, one, so he just kind of plays it flat. And maybe that the cops really don't know what they're doing. They're totally hoodwinked. They don't have any idea of what's going on.
Maybe so. I watched it. I actually watched the scene over after it happened again. I just, like, there's just something about the way the characters walk into the frame. Devane comes in from the left. Cops can come in from the right. They talk. They have this long scene, and then they just depart, and it's all in one shot. It's just – there's something so – it's almost Ed Woodian in a weird way, and that it's so flat. And I have to think that's – you know, Hitchcock's obviously doing it on purpose. It just made me laugh. Again, there's nothing funny inherently in the scene, but there's just something about the way William Devane says, that's right. He just gives this very basic information about this diamond stuff. And
Devane said that was his favorite beat in the entire movie.
Oh, really?
And the reason why was because the guy that played that cop was a good friend of his.
Oh, wow.
And they had originally shot – this is the shot that shows up in the movie was a second take, was a reshoot. And the original shot, there was Devane said there was like silver or mirrors or something in the background that Hitch didn't like. So they had to come back and reshoot it. Well, in the original take, at one point, as they're talking, Devane reaches over and acts like he's pulling a piece of lint off his coat and then kind of flicks it off. And Hitchcock says – don't do that. It's not clear. So they reshot it and did it again. Well, then when they came to reshoot it, it is in the movie because Devane turned to his buddy and said, "Hey, let's do that again. Let's do that again." So they did, and he picked some lint off his jacket and flicked it off, and then it stayed in the movie. Devane says, "Apparently Hitch forgot about it, and so we got it in there, and that's why it's my favorite beat in the whole movie."
I can see that. It is such a random, weird detail. Yeah,
and again, like you said, where I always think of Hitchcock as being so detail-oriented, but that wasn't what it was important to him. It was how that shot was framed, and there was something else about it that was important to him. That was just inconsequential.
Yeah, if you walked up to a stranger and they picked a piece of lint off your shirt, you'd be like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And this is – right after that is we have the only sort of – well, not the only, but the initial crossover between our two sets of couples where they go and they spy on George and Blanche. And we see that obviously there's not a lot of love lost between these two. Blanche complains that basically she wants George to spend the night and obviously presumably have sex. And George has the line, "I'm too pooped to pop," which is –
Yeah.
Okay.
Another, some of that sexual innuendo that, that is threaded through this entire movie.
Yeah. So, and then they, and we say that they immediately realize that George and Blanche are not, you know, they maybe don't have a whole lot to fear from these two. That they, and although at the same time, of course, just because you're inept at something doesn't mean you can't accidentally stumble into being the problem. So they're, right. they have to be, and they're, you know, they're sort of perfectly okay with the idea that, yeah, we may have to kill these two to cover up our tracks. And they're okay with that. They're perfectly fine with that because they kind of look at them like, well, you know, obviously if you're a kidnapper, you're pretty, you know, pretty ruthless kind of person. But I mean, they get the idea that, yeah, George and Blanche, yeah, we may have to just bump them off to keep our criminal scam going.
Yeah. And, you know, it was interesting too, I think, at the beginning of the movie, and like you said, these two couples and their how they interact is to me interesting. We have Fran and Devane, who seem like they're sort of in love, and they're, and he said, how was it Devane in his line as Adamson said something about we move as one, like they were really connected and they were sort of together in this. And then at the beginning, Dern and I keep saying they're at the actors' names, but Blanche and Lumley were sort of opposed, and they're kind of at it all the time. But as the movie progresses, it almost like they switch roles or switches where Blanche and Lumley become closer together. Where at the end, where he's trying to save her at the end, and where these two, we need to take care of these two. And then she kind of, no, I don't want to have anything to do with that. And suddenly it's like they may kind of get after each other, but those Lumley and Blanche are the two that are really in love. And the other two, it's just all a show or all part of the activity that they're involved in. The reward is something different.
After that, after Blanche and George go to this cafe and they're doing their investigating, that's when they do the scene with them careening down the mountain. And yes. it is pretty much like a cut scene from It's a Mad World. It is so absurd. Blanche's leg is going up in the air. She's grabbing George's tie. And it's just, again, none of it makes in a thriller. It is just, you're like, what is this scene? And it's supposed to be scary, and I guess it is on some level, but it's so absurd and so silly that, again, Blanche like keeps throwing her feet up in the air. I mean, you really expect Dick Shawn to show up at any moment or Milton Berle. It's so silly.
I think there are two kind of interesting behind-the-scenes things with that particular scene, too. Bruce Dern, in an interview, talked about he had asked Hitchcock about that. Hitchcock told him his theory about that scene, and he had used that same format all along in his movies. He told Dern, if you are in a vehicle, in this case a car, once you're in the car, you stay in the car. So he takes the close-ups of the actors, and then what he does from there is he uses the car's point of view. So if you notice in that scene, he kind of shows the brake fluid or whatever dripping out of the car. And then every scene, every cut from there, it's the actor's or the car's point of view. And he says, the reason I do that, it makes the viewer feel like they are in the car as it travels. And then, of course, after the whole thing is done and the car turns on its side, now you're external again. That was the first thing. The second thing was the assistant director was talking about he and Hitchcock had a discussion about that scene. And Kazanjian said he wanted Hitchcock to direct that scene. But Hitchcock had it listed with the second unit. And he said, why? And he said, I want you to do this. And he said, no, I need you to do it. And so Kazanjian, they had the discussion. He said, well, how would you do that scene? How do we do that scene? Hitchcock said to Kazanjian. And he said, well, you know, we'd have this and we'd do an insert car and we'd film this. And he said, well, where would the director sit? And he said, well, they would be on a seat in the back of the insert car. And Hitchcock says, precisely. Now do you get my point? Well, the idea was that Hitchcock was trying to convey was that he was having health issues. He could not do that physically rigorous of a scene anymore.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And so, again, that this kind of filtered into this being obviously what became his last movie. And like you said, when we talk about him not realizing his last movie, when we talk about that a little bit later, he was already starting to see he physically was unable to do some of the directorship there. So Hitchcock directed the scenes where they were in the car with the blue screen, and then Kazanjian directed the actual thing going down the road.
Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, yeah, I mean, Hitchcock was, what, 77 at this point?
Yeah, 76 or 77 at that time. And physically, that was another story Devane told about being in the car where Hitchcock, and there was a point in the movie where they were sitting there and they were getting, but he said, Devane said, we were just sitting there. And he said, I came, like you said, I came from television and theater. I wasn't familiar with movie. And I thought, why are we just sitting around? Well, all of a sudden, Hitchcock comes out with this box. And he goes through this whole thing. And he opens it up. And there's a phone. He's talking on the phone. He pulls out a microphone, opens up his shirt, holds it to his chest, the microphone, gets back on the call and says, okay, we're ready to go. He was checking. They were checking his pacemaker. To make sure it was okay. He said, they tell me everything's fine. We can continue now.
Wow.
And they say, okay. And then we went on. So he was definitely having health issues during this film as well.
Okay. Now, later on, after Maloney is killed, we go to Maloney's funeral. And then we have Katherine Hellman has her big scene, her one big scene. She's in the movie before this, but she has her one big solo scene as his widow. And there's a moment there that is just as silly as the car chase, but it's a lot more subtle because it goes by a lot faster and it just doesn't have the kinetic craziness. But Mrs. Maloney gets upset at her husband's funeral and she wanders off into the graveyard and George follows her. And there's this long shot where Hitchcock's got the camera way up in the sky and we're looking down at this field and we see that there are paths, you know, there are walking paths in between the gravestones. And she is walking through them and she notices that George is following her. And like it becomes almost like a game of Pac-Man where
right.
she kind of walks to the left and then he sees him going to the left and then she goes to the right. And you're like, we don't have to follow these paths, guys. You could just walk anywhere you want on the grass. And it's just such a silly little laugh moment where you're like, somehow this moment of someone being pursued by what she might think is like, maybe she's a kidnapper or something. She doesn't, Mrs. Maloney doesn't know. They're nevertheless adhering to these sort of weird rules. That's like, well, no, I can only walk in like the base pads or something like that. It's subtle because it goes by really fast, but it made me chuckle when I saw it because you're like, why are you honoring this? Just run away from the guy. You don't have to like follow the pads as if it's a rule.
Well, and it's funny, this Kazantzakian said this was one of, if not the most important shot for Hitchcock in this movie, that overhead shot. And again, that's his storyboard thing. And I can't help but think part of it was it was a visual representation of what he had said the theme was. Two separate stories about people crisscrossing and how they pass each other. That was the shot. If they're sort of, like you said, they're crisscrossing, they're not together, but they are. And where do the paths lead? And eventually they come together. And when they come together is sort of when Lumley learns Shoebridge is alive and he is Adamson. That became kind of a critical thing for all of its silliness, because I thought the exact same thing as I'm watching. This is Pac-Man.
Yeah.
We have ghosts working around and Pac-Man trying to avoid and find the little dot to eat.
Yeah.
And all this kind of stuff. And that's exactly what it was like.
Yeah.
And then I thought, but again, when I watched it again, after having heard the interview, I'm like, oh, this is one of those Hitchcockian levels. There's a different level there that I just didn't see the first time. And then when I hear what his idea was of the crisscrossing paths that come together, that does make sense now.
Yeah, it does make total sense. So eventually, all our characters do eventually cross paths with one another. They kidnap Blanche. They put her in their specialized little secret room. And then George follows up and sneaks into the house. And again, I don't know how you feel about it, but he's in his taxi uniform. And for 1976, I don't know whether this was old time even by that standards, but he's in like his little cap and a jacket. Like that looks out of date. Maybe it wasn't for 1976, but he looks like something you would see from 1940. He kind of, again, not to bring up Mad Men World again, but he looks like Peter Falk from It's Mad World, where it's like, why is he in this sort of formal cabbie uniform? Do cabbies dress like that in 1976?
Well, it makes me wonder two things. One, Hitch was totally out of touch with what he hadn't been in a cab for a long time, maybe. But also it makes me wonder of this idea that Hitchcock had of not assigning a place. Maybe he was also trying to not get so intent on assigning a time. And this could have taken place in, you know, this city, but maybe not, in this time frame, but maybe not. And again, maybe I'm giving Hitchcock too much credit because I think so highly of him. But I am totally like you. I kept thinking Milkman, too. Every time Milkman outfit.
Yeah.
I have never seen anyone like that in a cab in my lifetime that I remember. So.
Yeah. I mean, it literally says Central Cab on his hat. You know, like, really?
Right, exactly.
Is that how they dressed in 1976? He does a nice thing. George does a nice smart thing where he's skulking around and he takes his shoes off so he doesn't make noise, which I also thought was a nice touch. Like, again, that makes a lot of sense. He doesn't want to make noise. And so he ends up getting the drop on Arthur and Fran by after he rescues Blanche has been placed on knocked unconscious. He rescues her. Arthur and Fran wander into, because they wonder where Blanche is gone, they wander into their secret compartment, and that is when George springs the trap on them, and he traps them in their secret compartment. And that's it. That's it for them for the movie. Like, we don't see them after that. They slam the door, and it's sort of, again, I have to imagine intentionally comical or intentionally just strange, where we see George slam this fake brick wall against, it closes shut, and they have George and Blanche have this kind of heartfelt conversation up against the brick wall, and we don't hear Arthur or Fran pound the door or yell. Now, maybe it's soundproof.
They said earlier in the movie that it had been soundproof.
Oh, did they? Okay. All right. Yeah. I missed that part. All right. So, but it's just sort of funny that, like, they have this nice kind of little conversation and you're like, the bad guys are right on the other side of that wall and they don't seem terribly worried about it. Like, they're just like,
right. Exactly. Like, oh crap. You know, we got it.
All right. We're stuck in here.
And I found it totally appropriate though, too, that they sort of, this whole idea again, and I know with plot sometimes isn't, Hitchcock was more about the experience than sometimes the plot, because it was so twisty and turny. Didn't even this make sense? But I did find it interesting, too, that when they got caught in there, again, they got caught in their own plans. The whole reason George and Blanche were trying to find him was to tell him he could have $10 million as the heir to the Rainbird fortune.
Right.
And so, but then he thought it was because something else, that he was a crook, and he ended up getting caught in his own machination, so to speak. When if he would have just listened to them, he'd had millions and millions, could have continued on with his crime and been even wealthier. But he was so hard trying to not get caught, and then he gets caught in his own secret room, in his own secret room, his new identity, his new plan. And I just found that, yeah, that's about right, you know. And then there again, now we have what you said, the dissecting paths again. The paths have crossed. Now they're dissecting. They're trapped in there. We don't hear from them. And we follow Blanche and George on their path for one last scene.
It does remind you a little bit of the fact that that Norman Bates could have this whole first half of the movie is about the $40,000, the missing $40,000. And Norman Bates throws it into the mud. Because he doesn't know it's there, and he doesn't care it's there. So the whole MacGuffin, again, the term from Hitchcock, the whole MacGuffin that's driving the plot, which is the missing $40,000, halfway through the film becomes completely irrelevant because it doesn't matter anymore. And obviously Norman Bates is, as we know, is a psycho, so therefore he's not in it for the money. But it's like, geez, he really probably, if he had taken that money, he probably could have grabbed the $40,000 and skedaddled out of California.
Exactly.
And gotten away with it.
Nobody would have been the wiser.
Nobody would have known. No one ever would have found Marion Crane. So at the end of the movie, Blanche wanders out and she's sort of groggy because, again, she's been knocked out. And George places the phone call. He calls the cops. And we see Blanche finds the missing diamond that we saw in the earlier part of the film that they have taped up into the chandelier so it blends in with all the other lights, and she points to it, and George is like, Blanche, you're really a psychic, you really did it. And as he calls the cops, Blanche, Barbara Harris, sits on the stoop of the stairwell and looks directly into the camera and winks, which is, as far as I know, the only time in a Hitchcock movie that they have acknowledged the fourth wall. I thought, what an interesting way for the – it's literally the final shot Alfred Hitchcock – and maybe not ever directed, but it's the final shot of a Hitchcock movie. What a funny way to go out.
Yeah, and so appropriate, you know, for without knowing it was going to be his last film. You know, he didn't know that at that time. And it was very unusual, like you said, for any movie to really break that fourth wall and acknowledge the audience anyway, much less in a Hitchcock film. In this interview with Dern, this one just killed me too. Dern said that he had suggested to Hitchcock at the end that after they had found the diamond, the camera should pan to Hitchcock coming down the stairs and have Hitchcock wink.
Whoa.
And Hitchcock thought about it and then decided against it and stuck with this ending. And Dern says, can you imagine if that would have been the last scene in Hitchcock's last film? What that would have been like. And I thought it was perfect anyway. Yeah. The way, I mean, for an ending, just to have her look and turn and wink. What a great way to send Hitchcock out.
Yeah. Now
I've got a question for you.
Yes.
With this last scene. So we've clearly established throughout the entire movie, and you articulated it very well with her physicality and all that, she is a fake.
Yeah.
She's a fraud psychic. So what is your thought on how she finds this diamond?
That I was going to ask you the same thing because
I have an idea.
Okay, because George is like, Blanche, you're real. You're really a psychic. And we never get any sense that she really is a psychic. But we also never get a scene where she is somehow figured out where the jewel is. She's not shown where the jewel is.
Right.
So you're like, well, wait a minute. How does she know? And so to me, the movie leaves it unresolved as to whether was she in a psychic moment or something like that. But the wink seems to suggest that she's letting the audience know. Now I'm fooled. Even George, even he thinks I'm real when I'm not. But I don't know. I found it a little confusing, but I was okay with it.
This was my thought as I watched this movie. I watched it again yesterday to be up to date, and I hadn't caught this before. But when I don't think she actually got drugged, I think somehow she wasn't really unconscious.
Oh, okay.
For two reasons, when he sort of supposedly drugged her, she kind of passed out, and he carries her up the stairs. And at that point, they say something about the diamond, and he says, Well, something about it. And he says that it's in the chandelier. He said he told Fran that it was in the chandelier as they walked up the steps. So if she was really awake, she would have heard that.
Oh, okay.
And then when they go down, and if you remember, she's like laying on that cot, and Devane looks at her and says, she's still unconscious. And then he walks out. And then when George walks in, he looks at her, she's awake. And she looks at him like she's awake. So it made me wonder, was she faking being unconscious the whole time?
Hmm.
She had heard about the diamond, and then she faked again to Devane, or to Adamson, because when George came in, she was awake. And then they went out and then trapped him in the thing. So that was my thought. And then that's what she was winking. She was her little play was that she wasn't really knocked out that whole time. And so she's good at her craft.
That had not occurred to me.
Watch it again and see if you see that when they first injected her, and see if you see it the same way I do. Now, she did have little blood dots on her sleeve.
Right,
so,
which spills on her purse, which is how George finds her.
So it makes me wonder when they were struggling that he poke her, but it didn't get injected.
Right.
The ketamine. They were using ketamine all the time.
Right. Huh. Okay. So, that's interesting.
But
yeah.
The wink and the nod leaves it, like you said. Well, maybe she was a real psychic. Maybe she wasn't. There's a case to be made, maybe either way.
Yeah. That's again, it's a great grace note to go out on. And I said, and that is family plot. So we've already talked about was this intended as Hitchcock's final film? And we know, no, it was not. He actually immediately went to work on a script called The Short Night, which would have been a spy thriller. Apparently he had talked to Ed Lauder and about being in The Short Night. Now, again, according to IMDb, he had already worked, planned to have a bunch of actors in The Short Night, including Sean Connery, Liv Ullmann, Walter Matthau, and Rod Steiger. Which is like, good Lord, that's a huge cast. And again, coming off of his last couple of films where he was purposely featuring no stars, that seems go completely the other way. Sean Connery and Walter Matthau were huge stars at that point. So maybe, again, IMDb isn't always to be trusted, so who knows whether that is true or not. But The Short Night, he worked on it apparently for a couple of years. The script was published in a book about Hitchcock, so you can read The Short Night script, but it was never produced. Hitchcock, apparently his health just did not cooperate. And he made a final appearance in 1980 at an AFI dinner where I used to watch those when I worked at Movies Unlimited. I don't even think he ever says anything. It's a tribute to Hitchcock, but he just sits there and he doesn't look terribly happy. He doesn't look terribly healthy. And he ended up passing away not too long after that. And The Short Night was never produced.
Right.
I guess they figured that it's a Hitchcock script. Who could make a Hitchcock movie? Now, obviously, in the intervening decades, people have been very comfortable remaking Hitchcock, sometimes literally remaking a Hitchcock movie.
Well, shot for shot.
Shot for shot. But no, this was not intended as his final film. So, of course, that leads the question of how do you feel, Scott, about this as the summing up of his career? Does it sum up Alfred Hitchcock's career? Is it a nice capper? How do you feel about it being his final film?
Well, I'll at least start with a little bit about The Short Knight too, because I found some stuff on that. And you okay. talked about you're right. That movie was ready to be shot. I didn't read the stuff about who the cast were, but it was like literally ready to go. They were getting ready to shoot it. And apparently Hilton Green, who was a studio exec, I saw an interview with him. He said he was called by Hitchcock and said, "I need to see you in my office." Well, he said, so of course it was Hitchcock. I dropped everything and went down. And when Green went into his office, he said Hitchcock almost had tears in his eyes. And he said, "I can't go on."
Huh.
And Green said to him, I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "I can't do this picture. And I would like for you to do a favor for me." And Green says, of course I'll do you a favor, but why can't you?" And he said, "I'm just not up to it. I'm not strong enough to go on location." And Hitchcock was heartbroken. And Green said, "I tried to convince him, but he said he would never make a movie again."
Huh.
And Hitch then asked him to call Mr. Wasserman, who was one of the studio head, and tell him, because Hitchcock said he couldn't do it himself. He couldn't. Obviously, he didn't want to not do this movie. He felt like he couldn't. And then Green called Wasserman and told him. And so then he retired basically right then and there.
Oh, wow. So,
and then back to was this the cap on Hitchcock's career? Wow, that's a great question. I think if I took simply the very last scene with a wink and a nod to the audience, that's the cap I want from Hitchcock. And I think that was it. But as the movie as a whole, I liked the movie, but you know how it is. When you look backward, you think there are certain things you wanted to see as sort of this culmination of all that was Hitchcock before. This was a Hitchcock movie, but it wasn't necessarily a culmination of all that was before, sort right. of an end piece or a bookend to everything else. So I think in that respect, it really didn't feel like Hitchcock's last movie. But then I come to that last scene with the wink and the nod to the audience, and I feel good about it as Hitchcock's last film.
It's a very Hitchcockian. I mean, Hitchcock was doing it through his whole career, was winking.
Yes.
The audience. So it feels like a yes. sum up of all that. Yeah. I would argue it's probably one of my least favorite of his. I think it's too long. I think it's too drawn out. It's for all of its lightheartedness. It's not terribly funny. With the occasional Bruce Dern ad lib.
Comedic, but not funny.
Yeah, comedic, yes, yeah, would, perfect. Yeah, comedic, but not
that.
Funny. Picking off the lint off the cop shirt is funny. But it's not laugh out loud funny, and it's just a little too drawn out. And maybe it was simply that, Hitchcock was of a different vintage. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, Star Wars was 1 year away, and it would just completely change movies at that point in terms of the pace of movies, which is so funny now because you watch Star Wars now and it's like, well, this seems kind of slow in a good way. But, it's only because right. our attention spans have been reduced to nanoseconds at this point.
Yeah.
But it's a little slow. I think it is in the last clump of his movies, kind of, again, one of my lesser favorites. But there's a nimbleness to it in some ways, especially Bruce Dern, his physicality, the way he kind of like almost walks around on his tiptoes with his legs kind of bow-legged. Like it's a very fun comedic performance from Bruce Dern, and he really does give it some life to it. And it's nice to see, it's just fun to see four movie stars put through their paces. William Devane wasn't so much a movie star at that point, but nevertheless, he's a name that you recognize. He's a face you recognize. And Barbara Harris is fun. I recognize her. She appeared in Gross Point Blank and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Karen Black, of course, we're familiar with Karen Black. She's fun in it. She gets top billing, even though she probably gets the least to do of the four, probably because she was the biggest name at the time. So, yeah, it's not Hitchcock going out on his best, but we can argue what his best is. I mean, you can argue
sure.
Psycho or Rear Window.
He has lots of bests.
Lots of bests.
In the center there, yeah.
Career full of bests. He's got a lot of them. But it's a nice – it's nothing to be I don't want to use the word ashamed because that's too heavy, but there are other filmmakers who we might get to on this show who their last films are dismal, or just utterly,
right.
Oh my God, this guy totally lost it. But, Hitchcock was slowing down for a 76-year-old man, not a bad effort. Again, not certainly wouldn't be in the top. It would be the bottom third of if somebody said, give me the list of Hitchcock movies to see, this would be in the bottom third of the ones I would say get to. Ahead of, get through after you get to Psycho, after you get to North Pole Northwest, after you do Psych, Rear Window, you can go to this one. But nevertheless, it was still a fun watch, and I enjoyed it reviewing it again for the show.
And, I think it's interesting, too, like you said, it in its own way, and I agree with everything that you said, and it makes me wonder, too, if it wasn't maybe an appropriate end in the sense that Hitchcock style of filmmaking, as Karen Black had mentioned when I talked about the interview, was sort of something of time past, mm-hmm. and how movies were made, and as you said, with Star Wars would be made, this just was sort of a bit of a vestige of an old Hitchcock and a Hitchcock that wasn't really fitting in with what movies were now and what right. they would be. And, you know, maybe it was time for it to be his last movie. And physically, I think he saw that. But again, it was not one of his best, but it wasn't bad.
Right.
You know, if you look, I think on Rotten Tomatoes, it actually has a pretty high Rotten Tomatoes score. Which, right, for a movie that I don't think probably many people are familiar with out of right. Hitchcock's catalog, that was sort of surprising to me when I looked at that. That's like, oh, people liked it, but it's not, again, Hitchcockian right. when you think of this otherworldly type thing. I do want to riff back on one thing you said, too, about Star Wars coming up, because, and we've talked about this a little bit on Film and Water, we didn't talk about the score.
No, John Williams.
John Williams of Star Wars and many other movies fame. Yeah. He had just come off Jaws, did the score for this film. I saw an interview with John Williams talking about this. And he told a couple interesting little anecdotes. The first one he talked about, there was the scene, and we mentioned that, we talked about it a little bit, in the jewelry store where Maloney comes to visit. And then Adamson goes out to talk to the cops. And when he comes back into the room, Maloney's gone. The window is open.
I love
and the
that. It's
are,
like Batman.
yes, they're flat. The curtains are flapping in the breeze. And Williams talked about that scene. He said, I had scored it, and I had this kind of raising music in to get the anticipation. And he opens the door, and he said, and we cut to the window open with the breeze flapping. He said, and I had the music continue. He said, I sat with Hitchcock, and Hitchcock said, you should stop the music when the door opened. And he said, and Williams thought about it, and he said, well, and Hitchcock said, there will be more power in the fact of silence in this instance because it shows emptiness, empty room. He's escaped. And Williams said, I learned that from Hitchcock. I was early in my career then as a young composer, and he said that silence more powerfully shows that he got away than any musical note could. He said that was something that Hitchcock taught me at that point, which I found so fascinating because I think of John Williams. You know, when I think of musical scores, he's at the top of the list.
Yeah.
And here as a younger composer, Hitchcock, who was not a composer, had taught him about and Williams called it spotting, where the music fits into these spots in the scene. I thought that was interesting. The second one, Williams was telling, he said Hitch told me a story about how he'd been making a film about a murder and that he had told the composer for that film to make the music light. But the composer used every instrument he could to make the music ominous and a murder. And it was the opposite of what Hitch wanted. And Williams said, well, I told Hitch, I said, I thought that for a murder, that seems very appropriate. And Hitch responded, Mr. Williams, murder can be fun. And he said, and Williams said, I love that. He said, I remember that quote word for word, and I say it all the time. And again, I think, again, that sums up Hitchcock.
Yeah, he had that in his hip pocket. You know, yes, he was waiting.
Absolutely.
Pull that out to somebody. Oh, here, I can use
I'm this. Waiting for this one.
He's like the Terminator with the little responses, you know, what to say to the guy who's knocking on his motel room. You know, Hitchcock, murder can be fun. Okay, that's great. I got my Hitchcock moment. Thank you very much. I appreciate
yes.
it. Yeah. The one other thing I wanted to mention when I was thinking about the movie is that it's a we talk about that, you know, he's kind of old school and that Hitchcock was obviously of a different vintage, that it's a very chaste movie. There's no nudity in it. I mean, other than I'm too pooped to pop, which is a pretty benign kind of line, really. It's a very PG movie for a movie about murder. There's not a lot of violence in it. There's no stabbings. And his previous film, Frenzy, featured much more explicit violence and nudity. Which is the only time I think we believe a Hitchcock film yeah. had those things. And so it's like, well, so he was willing to play in that yard a little bit and say, okay, well, it's 1972 and, you know, the ultra, you know, a little bit of the ultra violence is getting, becoming part of
it's
what movie going is
so
at
speak.
That point.
Yeah.
yeah. And he was willing to go. And I remember watching Frenzy for the first time and there's nudity. And I was like shocked because I wasn't expecting nudity in a Hitchcock film. But there it is. And so he kind of then went back for this one and made it a lot, you know, a lot more. I mean, you could show this to even the youngest kid now, whether they would, it would hold their attention. I don't know, but there's nothing in it objectionable Right. Considering it's got all this skullduggery going on and murder and all this, you know, furtive behavior, and yet it said it's a fairly chaste movie. So, you know, I could see almost like he was like, okay, I did that. I did the extra sex right. and extra violence, but I don't want to do that again for this.
And that was always one of Hitchcock's, you know, great lines. And I can't remember if it was with Truffaut or who it was that he told that to, and they talked about Psycho and about how he really didn't show the murder,
right.
you know, and his response was that I can set the stage, but whatever people can create in their mind is much more powerful than what I can show on screen. Mm. And I think, like you said, I think maybe he came back to that and said his idea was about to show only so far and let the person's mind go those next steps. And that's a lot of that sexual innuendo that you see in this movie, that you don't see it. It's not overt, but the person listening for that is going to hear that and get a chuckle out of it
or get
an image in their mind generated from that. And that was more his style than that overt violence or sex or whatever.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and then the final thing we want to talk about is like the film's legacy. If it has much of one, it's not something that is part of the culture, the way certainly Psycho or North by Northwest or some of his other classics are. It's not a film like, you know, a bunch of years ago in the 90s, a bunch of Hitchcock films, whose negatives had been wasting away got refurbished and restored and got put back out on the big screen. And obviously Family Plot is not one of those. It's definitely, I'd say, considering probably one of the lesser titles, but in a career consisting of, you know, dozens and dozens of movies, I like that when someone has a deep catalog to dive into, you know? So yeah, again, I would say it's one of the lesser films, but it's a fun capper on his career. And after you've seen Psycho for the 75th time, give Family Plot a run, you know, give it a shot.
Right.
And just say, oh, look, this is a fun, different take. It's much more of a comedy. It's not something you'd never really saw with Hitchcock for a long time. So it's not one you're going to watch a lot, but it's a nice, there's this other movie I never seen before. That's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it has a little bit of a different flavor. And for people like you and I who just, I'm sort of, that's part of my comic book personality too.
Right. Yeah.
A bit of a completionist. I want to see each of these films and kind of set them in. Now, is it one of my very favorites? No. But do I think it's a bad film? No. Give it a try. You know, it's a little bit different flavor of Hitchcock, but it's still Hitchcock.
Absolutely. So, all right. I think that's going to do it for Family Plot. And this is going to do it for the very first episode of Fade Out. So, Scott, you know, I always enjoy talking to you, and I really appreciate you joining me on this maiden voyage for this new show.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And I'm so thrilled that you had this idea, which I think is fantastic. Kind of this idea of the last film of some of these iconic actors, directors, people in the movie business. I think it's a great idea, and I'm really, really feel privileged to have been able to talk about this movie with you.
Well, thank you. Why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
You can find me. I am on Twitter. My handle is @themindofscottx. Sometimes I'm busy on Twitter, usually spamming up your feed on Saturday nights, Sci-Fi Saturday Night, as we do essentially a riff track and of whatever Sven Gulli has on, and some episodes of Star Trek and Buck Rogers in the 25th century. So you can follow me on there, and Rob joins in on that from time to time too.
I do.
And we can have a little bit of fun doing that. You can find me on any number of shows here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network as a guest, and also one over. I've also done a podcast on the DC OCD with Paul Hicks and Mike Garvey. So you can find me out there, and hopefully I'll be on a few more shows coming down the road too. Have some thoughts and ideas, and maybe someday I'll have one of my own. I've been throwing that around for a while, so we'll see.
Oh, I would love that. That would be great if you had your own thing. So that would be really cool. Absolutely. So yeah, and you'll be back here on the network of that, I am sure. So thank you everybody for listening. Of course, you can subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts and all the other podcast catchers that are out there. You can follow the show on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. The show has a Twitter account because of course it does. You can follow it @FadeOutPod. And finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So that is going to do it for Fade Out. We will be back in 2 weeks for the next episode. But until then, we've reached the end of the script. So it's time to fade out.